their own horses in, allowing their pursuers to close the distance. Every now and then another thud smote the air and shivered through the ground as one of the remaining tankers blew up. Roland was amazed at how easy it had been, even after the battle with Jonas and Lengel, which should have put the men out here on their mettle. It had been easy. It made him think of a Reaptide long ago, he and Cuthbert surely no more than 7 years old, running along a line of stuffy guys with sticks, knocking them over one after the other. Bang, bang, bangity, bang. The sound of the thinny was warbling its way into his brain in spite of the bandana over his ears, making his eyes water. Behind him he could hear the whoops and shouts of the pursuing men. It delighted him. Latigo's men had counted the odds, 24 against 3, with many more of their own force riding hard to join the battle, and their peckers were up once more. Roland faced front and pointed Rusher at the slit in the brush marking the entrance to Eyebolt Canyon. 18. Hendricks fell in beside Latigo, breathing hard, cheeks glaring with color.
"Sir, beg to report."
"Then do it.
I have 20 men, and they're perhaps 3 times that number riding hard to join us."
Latigo ignored all of this. His eyes were bright blue flecks of ice. Under his mustache was a small, greedy smile.
"Rodney,"
he said, speaking Hendricks's first name almost with the caress of a lover.
"Sir?"
"I think they're going in, Rodney."
"Yes. Look, I'm sure of it. 2 more minutes and it'll be too late for them to turn back."
He raised his gun, laid the muzzle across his forearm, and threw a shot at the 3 riders ahead, mostly in exuberance.
"Yes, sir. Very good, sir."
Hendricks turned and waved viciously for his men to close up. Close up. 19.
"Dismount,"
Roland shouted when they reached the line of tangled brush. It had a smell that was at once dry and oily, like a fire waiting to happen. He didn't know if their failure to ride their horses into the canyon would put Latigo's wind up or not, and he didn't care. These were good mounts, fine Gilead stock, and over these last months Rusher had become his friend. He would not take him or any of the horses into the canyon, where they would be caught between the fire and the thinny. The boys were off the horses in a flash, Alen pulling the drawstring bag free of his saddle horn and slinging it over one shoulder. Cuthbert's and Alen's horses ran at once, whinnying, parallel to the brush. But Rusher lingered for a moment, looking at Roland.
"Go on," Roland slapped him on the flank. "Run."
Rusher ran, tails streaming out behind him. Cuthbert and Alen slipped through the break in the brush. Roland followed, glancing down to make sure that the powder trail was still there. It was, and still dry. There had been not a drop of rain since the day they'd laid it.
"Cuthbert," he said, "matches."
Cuthbert gave him some. He was grinning so hard it was a wonder they hadn't fallen out of his mouth.
"We warmed up their day, didn't we, Roland?"
"Aye." "We did indeed," Roland said, grinning himself. "Go on now, back to that chimney cut."
"Let me do it," Cuthbert said. "Please, Roland, you go with Alen and let me stay. I'm a firebug at heart, always have been."
"No," Roland said. "This part of it's mine. Don't argue with me, go on. And tell Alen to mind the wizard's glass no matter what." Cuthbert looked at him for a moment longer, then nodded.
"Don't wait too long."
"I won't." "May your luck rise, Roland." "May yours rise twice." Cuthbert hurried away, boots rattling on the loose stone which carpeted the floor of the canyon. He reached Alen, who lifted a hand to Roland. Roland nodded back, then ducked as a bullet snapped close enough to his temple to flick his hat brim. He crouched to the left of the opening in the brush and peered around, the wind now striking full in his face. Latigo's men were closing rapidly, more rapidly than he had expected. If the wind blew out the Lucifers... Never mind the ifs. Hold on, Roland. Hold on. Wait for them. He held on, hunkering with an unlit match in each hand, now peering out through a tangle of interlaced branches. The smell of mesquite was strong in his nostrils. Not far behind it was the reek of burning oil. The drone of the thinny filled his head, making him feel dizzy, a stranger to himself. He thought of how it had been inside the pink storm, flying through the air, how he had been snatched away from his vision of Susan. Thank God for Shimi, he thought distantly. He'll make sure she finishes the day someplace safe. But the craven whine of the thinny seemed somehow to mock him, to ask him if there had been more to see. Now Letigo and his men were crossing the last 300 yards to the canyon's mouth at a full-out gallop, the ones behind closing up fast. It would be hard for the ones riding point to stop suddenly without the risk of being ridden down. It was time. Roland stuck one of the lucifers between his front teeth and raked it forward. It lit, spilling one hot and sour spark onto the wet bed of his tongue. Before the lucifer's head could burn away, Roland touched it to the powder in the trench. It lit at once, running left beneath the north end of the brush in a bright yellow thread. He lunged across the opening, which might be wide enough for two horses running flank to flank, with the second lucifer already poised behind his teeth. He struck it as soon as he was somewhat blocked from the wind, dropped it into the powder, heard the splutter hiss, then turned and ran. 20. Mother and father, was Roland's first shocked thought. Memory so deep and unexpected, it was like a slap. At Lake Saroni. When had they gone there? To beautiful Lake Saroni in the northern part of Gilead Barony. That Roland couldn't remember. He knew only that he had been very small, and that there had been a beautiful stretch of sandy beach for him to play on, perfect for an aspiring young castle builder such as he. That was what he had been doing on one day of their vacation. Was it a vacation? Did my parents once upon a time actually take a vacation trip? And he had looked up. Something, maybe only the cries of the birds circling over the lake, had made him look up. And there were his mother and father, Stephen and Gabrielle Deschaine, at the water's edge, standing with their backs to him and their arms around each other's waists, looking out at blue water beneath a blue summer sky. How his heart had filled with love for them, how infinite was love, twining in and out of hope and memory, like a braid with three strong strands, so much the bright tower of every human's life and soul. It wasn't love he felt now, however, but terror. The figures standing before him as he ran back to where the canyon ended, where the rational part of the canyon ended, weren't Stephen of Gilead and Gabrielle of Arton, but his mollies, Cuthbert and Elaine. They didn't have their arms around each other's waists either, but their hands were clasped, like the hands of fairy tale children lost in a threatening fairy tale wood. Birds circled, but they were vultures, not gulls, and the shimmering, mist-topped stuff before the two boys wasn't water. It was the thinny. And as Roland watched, Cuthbert and Alain began to walk toward it. "Stop!" he screamed. "For your father's sake, stop!" They did not stop. They walked hand in hand toward the white-edged hem of the smoky green shimmer. The thinny whined its pleasure, murmured endearments, promised rewards. It baked the nerves numb and picked at the brain. There was no time to reach them, so Roland did the only thing he could think of, raised one of his guns and fired it over their heads. The report was a hammer blow in the canyon's enclosure, and for a moment the ricochet whine was louder than that of the thinny. The two boys stopped only inches from its sick shimmer. Roland kept expecting it to reach out and grab them, as it had grabbed the low-flying bird when they had been here on the night of the peddler's moon. He triggered two more shots into the air, the reports hitting the walls and rolling back. "Gunslingers!" he cried. "To me! To me!" It was Alain who turned toward him first, his dazed eyes seeming to float in his dust-streaked face. Cuthbert continued forward another step, the tips of his boots disappearing in the greenish-silver froth at the edge of the thinny. The whinging grumble of the thing rose half a note, as if in anticipation, and then Alain yanked him back by the tug-string of his sombrero. Cuthbert tripped over a good-sized chunk of fallen rock and landed hard. When he looked up, his eyes had cleared. "Gods!" he murmured, and as he scrambled to his feet, Roland saw that the toes of his boots were gone, clipped off neatly as if with a pair of gardening shears.
His great toes stuck out. "Roland!" he gasped as he and Alain stumbled toward him. "Roland! We were almost gone. It talks."
"Yes, I've heard it. Come on, there's no time." He led them to the notch in the canyon wall, praying that they could get up quick enough to avoid being riddled with bullets, as they certainly would be if Letigo arrived before they could get up at least part of the way. A smell, acrid and bitter, began to fill the air, an odor like boiling juniper berries, and the first tendrils of whitish-gray smoke drifted past them.
"Cuthbert, you first. Alain, you next. I'll come last. Climb fast, boys. Climb for your lives."
Letigo's men poured through the slot in the wall of brush like water pouring into a funnel, gradually widening the gap as they came. The bottom layer of the dead vegetation was already on fire, but in their excitement none of them saw those first low flames, or marked them if they did. The pungent smoke also went unnoticed. Their noses had been deadened by the colossal stench of the burning oil. Letigo himself, in the lead, with Hendricks close behind, had only one thought, two words that pounded at his brain in a kind of vicious triumph. Box Canyon! Box Canyon! Box Canyon! Yet something began to intrude on this mantra as he galloped deeper into Eyebolt, his horse's hooves clattering nimbly through the scree of rocks and bones, whitish piles of cow skulls and rib cages. This was a kind of low buzzing, a maddening, slobbering whine, insectile and insistent. It made his eyes water. Yet strong as the sound was, if it was a sound, it almost seemed to be coming from inside him, he pushed it aside, holding onto his mantra, "Box Canyon, Box Canyon," got him in a Box Canyon instead. He would have to face Walter when this was over, perhaps Farson himself, and he had no idea what his punishment would be for losing the tankers, but all that was for later. Now he wanted only to kill these interfering bastards. Up ahead, the canyon took a jog to the north. They would be beyond that point, and probably not far beyond either, backed up against the canyon's final wall, trying to squeeze themselves behind what fallen rocks there might be. Letigo would mass what guns he had and drive them out into the open with ricochets. They would probably come with their hands up, hoping for mercy. They would hope in vain. After what they'd done, the trouble they'd caused, as Letigo rode around the jog in the canyon's wall, already leveling his pistol, his horse screamed, like a woman it screamed, and reared beneath him. Letigo caught the saddle horn and managed to stay up, but the horse's rear hooves slid sideways in the scree, and the animal went down. Letigo let go of the horn and threw himself clear, already aware that the sound which had been creeping into his ears was suddenly 10 times stronger, buzzing, loud enough to make his eyeballs pulse in their sockets, loud enough to make his balls tingle unpleasantly, loud enough to blot out the mantra which had been beating so insistently in his head. The insistence of the thinny was far, far greater than any George Letigo could have managed. Horses flashed around him as he landed in a kind of sprawling squat, horses that were shoved forward willy-nilly by the oncoming press from behind, by riders that squeezed through the gap in pairs, then trios as the hole in the brush, now burning all along its length, widened, and then spread out again once they were past the bottleneck, none of them clearly realizing that the entire canyon was a bottleneck. Letigo got a confused glimpse of black tails and gray forelegs and dappled fetlocks. He saw chaps and jeans and boots jammed into stirrups. He tried to get up, and a horseshoe clanged against the back of his skull. His hat saved him from unconsciousness, but he went heavily to his knees with his head down, like a man who means to pray, his vision full of stars, and the back of his neck instantly soaked with blood from the gash the passing hoof had opened in his scalp. Now he heard more screaming horses, screaming men as well. He got up again, coughing out the dust raised by the passing horses, such acrid dust, too, it clawed his throat like smoke, and saw Hendricks trying to spur his horse south and east against the oncoming tide of riders. He couldn't do it. The rear third of the canyon was some sort of swamp, filled with greenish, steaming water, and there must be quicksand beneath it because Hendricks's horse seemed stuck. It screamed again and tried to rear. Its hindquarters slewed sideways. Hendricks crashed his boots into the animal's sides again and again, attempting to get it in motion, but the horse didn't, or couldn't, move. That hungry buzzing sound filled Letigo's ears and seemed to fill the world.
"Back! Turn back!"
He tried to scream the words, but they came out in what was little more than a croak. Still, the riders pounded past him, raising dust that was too thick to be only dust. Letigo pulled in breath so he could scream louder. They had to go back. Something was dreadfully wrong in Eyebolt Canyon, and hacked it out without saying anything. Screaming horses, reeking smoke, and everywhere, filling the world like lunacy, that whining, whinging, cringing buzz. Hendrix's horse went down, eyes rolling, bit-parted teeth snapping at the smoky air and splattering curds of foam from its lips. Hendrix fell into the steaming, stagnant water, and it wasn't water at all. It came alive somehow as he struck it, grew green hands and a green, shifty mouth, pawed his cheek and melted away the flesh, pawed his nose and tore it off, pawed at his eyes and stripped them from their sockets. It pulled Hendrix under, but before it did, Letigo saw his denuded jawbone, a bloody piston to drive his screaming teeth. Other men saw and tried to wheel away from the green trap. Those who managed to do so in time were broadsided by the next wave of men, some of whom were, incredibly, still yipping or bellowing full-throated battle cries. More horses and riders were driven into the green shimmer, which accepted them eagerly. Letigo, standing stunned and bleeding like a man in the middle of a stampede, which was exactly what he was, saw the soldier to whom he had given his gun. This fellow, who had obeyed Letigo's order and shot one of his compadres in order to awaken the rest of them, threw himself from his saddle, howling, and crawled back from the edge of the green stuff even as his horse plunged in. He tried to get to his feet, saw two riders bearing down on him, and clapped his hands across his face. A moment later he was ridden down. The shrieks of the wounded and dying echoed in the smoky canyon, but Letigo hardly heard them. What he heard mostly was that buzzing, a sound that was almost a voice, inviting him to jump in, to end it here. Why not? It was over, wasn't it? All over. He struggled away instead, and was now able to make some headway. The stream of riders packing its way into the canyon was easing. Some of the riders 50 or 60 yards back from the jog had even been able to turn their horses. But these were ghostly and confused in the thickening smoke. "The cunning bastards have set the brush on fire behind us. Gods of heaven, gods of earth, I think we're trapped in here." He could give no commands. Every time he drew in breath to try, he coughed it wordlessly back out again. But he was able to grab a passing rider who looked all of 17 and yank him out of his saddle. The boy went down head first and smashed his brow open on a jutting chunk of rock. Letigo was mounted in his place before the kid's feet had stopped twitching. He jerked the horse's head around and spurred for the front of the canyon, but the smoke thickened to a choking white cloud before he got more than 20 yards. The wind was driving it this way. Letigo could make out barely the shifting orange glare of the burning brush at the desert end. He wheeled his new horse back the way it had come. More horses loomed out of the fog. Letigo crashed into one of them and was thrown for the second time in 5 minutes. He landed on his knees, scrambled to his feet, and staggered back downwind, coughing and retching, eyes red and streaming. It was a little better beyond the canyon's northward jog, but wouldn't be for much longer. The edge of the thinny was a tangle of milling horses, many with broken legs, and crawling, shrieking men. Letigo saw several hats floating on the greenish surface of the whining organism that filled the back of the canyon. He saw boots, he saw wristlets, he saw neckerchiefs, he saw the bugle boy's dented instrument still trailing its frayed strap. "Come in," the green shimmer invited, and Letigo found its buzz strangely attractive, intimate, almost. "Come in and visit. Squat and hunker. Be at rest. Be at peace. Be at one." Letigo raised his gun, meaning to shoot it. He didn't believe it could be killed, but he would remember the face of his father and go down shooting all the same. Except he didn't. The gun dropped from his relaxing fingers, and he walked forward. Others around him were now doing the same, into the thinny. The buzzing rose and rose, filling his ears until there was nothing else. Nothing else at all. 22. They saw it all from the notch, where Roland and his friends had stopped in a strung-out line about 20 feet below the top. They saw the screaming confusion, the panicky milling, the men who were trampled, the men and horses that were driven into the thinny, and the men who, at the end, walked willingly into it. Cuthbert was closest to the top of the canyon's wall, then Alain, then Roland, standing on a 6-inch shelf of rock and holding an outcrop just above him. From their vantage point they could see what the men struggling in their smoky hell below them could not, that the thinny was growing, reaching out, crawling eagerly toward them like an incoming tide. Roland, his battle lust slaked, did not want to watch what was happening below, but he couldn't turn away. The whine of the thinny, cowardly and triumphant at the same time, happy and sad at the same time, lost and found at the same time, held him like sweet, sticky ropes. He hung where he was, hypnotized, as did his friends above him, even when the smoke began to rise and its pungent tang made him cough dryly. Men shrieked their lives away in the thickening smoke below. They struggled in it like phantoms. They faded as the fog thickened, climbing the canyon walls like water. Horses whinnied desperately from beneath that acrid white death. The wind swirled its surface in prankish whirlpools. The thinny buzzed. And above where it lay, the surface of the smoke was stained a mystic shade of palest green. Then, at long last, John Farson's men screamed no more. "We killed them," Roland thought with a kind of sick and fascinated horror. "Then, no, not we, I killed them." How long he might have stayed there, Roland didn't know. Perhaps until the rising smoke engulfed him as well. But then Cuthbert, who had begun to climb again, called down 3 words from above him, called down in a tone of surprise and dismay. "Roland! The moon!" Roland looked up, startled, and saw that the sky had darkened to a velvety purple. His friend was outlined against it and looking east, his face stained fever orange with the light of the rising moon. "Yes, orange," the thinny buzzed inside his head, laughed inside his head. "Orange as 'twas when it rose on the night you came out here to see me and count me. Orange like a fire, orange like a bonfire." "How can it be almost dark?" he cried inside himself. But he knew. Yes, he knew very well. Time had slipped back together. That was all like layers of ground embracing once more after the argument of an earthquake. Twilight had come. Moonrise had come. Terror struck Roland like a closed fist aimed at the heart, making him jerk backward on the small ledge he'd found. He groped for the horn-shaped outcrop above him, but that act of rebalancing was far away. Most of him was inside the pink storm again, before he had been snatched away and shown half the cosmos. Perhaps the wizard's glass had only shown him what stood worlds far away in order to keep from showing him what might soon befall so close to home. "I'd turn around if I thought her life was in any real danger," he had said, "in a second." And if the ball knew that? If it couldn't lie, might it not misdirect? Might it not take him away and show him a dark land, a darker tower? And it had shown him something else, something that recurred to him only now, a scrawny man in farmer's overalls who had said, what? Not quite what he'd thought, not what he had been used to hearing all his life, not life for you and life for your crop, but death, he whispered to the stones surrounding him. Death for you, life for my crop. Charyu tree. That's what he said. Charyu tree. Come reap.
Orange, gunslinger.
A cracked old voice laughed inside his head. The voice of the coos.
The color of bonfires. Charyu tree. Fin de año. These are the old ways of which only the stuffy guys with their red hands remain. Until tonight. Tonight the old ways are refreshed, as the old ways must be from time to time. Char you tree, you damned babby, char you tree! Tonight you pay for my sweet Ermac. Tonight you pay for all. Come, reap!
Climb! He screamed, reaching up and slapping Alain's behind. Climb, climb, for your father's sake, climb! Roland, what? Alain's voice was dazed, but he did begin to climb, going from handhold to handhold and rattling small pebbles down into Roland's upturned face. Squinting against their fall, Roland reached and swatted Al's bottom again, driving him like a horse. Climb, goddamn you, he cried. It mayn't be too late, even now. But he knew better. Demon Moon had risen. He had seen its orange light shining on Cuthbert's face like delirium, and he knew better. In his head the lunatic buzz of the thinny, that rotting sore eating through the flesh of reality, joined with the lunatic laughter of the witch, and he knew better. Death for you, life for the crop, char you tree. Oh, Susan. Nothing was clear to Susan until she saw the man with the long red hair and the straw hat which did not quite obscure his lamb slaughterer's eyes. The man with the corn shucks in his hands. He was the first. Just a farmer, she had glimpsed him in the lower market, she thought, had even nodded to him as country folk do, and he back to her, standing by himself, not far from the place where Silk Ranch Road and the Great Road intersected, standing in the light of the rising moon. Until they came upon him, nothing was clear. After he hurled his bundle of corn shucks at her as she passed, standing in the slowly rolling cart with her hands bound in front of her and her head lowered and a rope around her neck, everything was clear. "Char you tree," he called, almost sweetly uttering words of the old people she hadn't heard since her childhood, words that meant come reap, and something else as well. Something hidden, something secret, something to do with that root word, char, that word which meant only death. As the dried shucks fluttered around her boots, she understood the secret very well. Understood also that there would be no baby for her, no wedding for her in the fairy distant land of Gilead, no hall in which she and Roland would be joined and then saluted beneath the electric lights, no husband, no more nights of sweet love. All that was over. The world had moved on, and all that was over. Done before fairly begun. She knew that she had been put in the back of the cart, stood in the back of the cart, and that the surviving coffin hunter had looped a noose around her neck. "Don't try to sit," he had said, sounding almost apologetic. "I have no desire to choke you, girlie. If the wagon bumps and you fall, I'll try to keep the knot loose, but if you try to sit, I have to give you a pension. Her orders." He nodded to Rhea, who sat erect on the seat of the cart, the reins in her warped hands. "She's in charge now." And so she had been. So as they neared town, she still was. Whatever the possession of her glam had done to her body, whatever the loss of it had done to her mind, it had not broken her power. That seemed to have increased, if anything, as if she'd found some other source from which she could feed, at least for a while. Men who could have broken her over one knee like a stick of kindling followed her commands as unquestioningly as children. There were more and more men as that reaping afternoon wound its shallow course to night. Half a dozen ahead of the cart riding with Rhymer and the man with the cocked eye, a full dozen riding behind it. With Reynolds, the rope leading to her neck wound around his tattooed hand at their head. She didn't know who these men were or how they had been summoned. Rhea had taken this rapidly increasing party north a little farther, then turned southwest on the old Silk Ranch Road, which wound back toward town. On the eastern edge of Hambry, it rejoined the Great Road. Even in her dazed state, Susan had realized the Harridan was moving slowly, measuring the descent of the sun as they went, not clucking at the pony to hurry, but actually reining it in, at least until afternoon's gold had gone.
When they pass the farmer, thin-faced and alone, a good man, no doubt, with a freehold farm he worked hard from first gleam to last glow, and a family he loved, but oh, there were those lamb-slaughterer eyes below the brim of his battered hat. She understood this leisurely course of travel, too. Rhea had been waiting for the moon. With no gods to pray to, Susan prayed to her father.
"Da, if these there help me to be strong as I can be, and help me hold to him, to the memory of him, help me hold to myself as well, not for rescue, not for salvation, but just so as not to give them the satisfaction of seeing my pain and my fear. And him, help him as well. Help keep him safe," she whispered. "Keep my love safe. Take my love safe to where he goes, give him joy in who he sees, and make him a cause of joy in those who see him."
"Prayin', dearie?"
the old woman asked without turning on the seat. Her croaking voice oozed false compassion.
"Aye, you do well to make things right with the powers while you still can. Before the spit's burned right out of your throat!"
She threw back her head and cackled, the straggling remains of her broom-straw hair flying out orange in the light of the bloated moon. 24. Their horses, led by Rusher, had come to the sound of Roland's dismayed shout. They stood not far away, their manes rippling in the wind, shaking their heads and whinnying their displeasure whenever the wind dropped enough for them to get a whiff of the thick white smoke rising from the canyon. Roland paid no attention to the horses or the smoke. His eyes were fixed on the drawstring sack slung over Alain's shoulder. The ball inside had come alive again. In the growing dark, the bag seemed to pulse like some weird pink firefly. He held out his hands for it. "Give it to me." "Roland, I don't know if—" "Give it to me, damn your face!" Alain looked at Cuthbert, who nodded, then lifted his hands skyward in a weary, distracted gesture. Roland tore the bag away before Alain could do more than begin to shrug it off his shoulder. The gunslinger dipped into it and pulled the glass out. It was glowing fiercely, a pink demon moon instead of an orange one. Behind and below them, the nagging whine of the thinny rose and fell, rose and fell.
"Don't look directly into that thing," Cuthbert muttered to Alain. "Don't, for your father's sake."
Roland bent his face over the pulsing ball, its light running over his cheeks and brow like liquid, drowning his eyes in its dazzle. In Merlin's rainbow, he saw her. Susan, horse-drover's daughter, lovely girl at the window. He saw her standing in the back of a black cart decorated with gold symbols, the old witch's cart. Reynolds rode behind her, holding the end of a rope that was noosed around her neck. The cart was rolling toward Greenheart, making its way with processional slowness. Hill Street was lined with people, of whom the farmer with the lamb-slaughterer's eyes had been only the first, all those folk of Hambry and Magus who had been deprived of their fare, but were now given this ancient dark attraction in its stead. "Char you tree, come reap, death for you, life for our crops." A soundless whispering ran through them like a gathering wave, and they began to pelter first with corn husks, then with rotting tomatoes, then with potatoes and apples. One of these latter struck her cheek. She reeled, almost fell, then stood straight again, now raising her swollen but still lovely face so the moon painted it. She looked straight ahead. "Char you tree," they whispered. Roland couldn't hear them, but he could see the words on their lips. Stanley Ruiz was there, and Petty, and Gert Moggins, and Frank Claypool, the deputy with a broken leg. Jamie McCann, who was to have been this year's Reap lad. Roland saw 100 people he had known and mostly liked during his time in Magus. Now these people pelted his love with corn shucks and vegetables as she stood hands bound before her in the back of Rhea's cart. The slowly rolling cart reached Greenheart with its colored paper lanterns and silent carousel where no laughing children rode, no, not this year. The crowd, still speaking those two words, chanting them now, it appeared, parted. Roland saw the heaped pyramid of wood that was the unlit bonfire. Sitting around it, their backs propped on the central column, their lumpy legs outstretched, was a ring of red-handed stuffy guys. There was a single hole in the ring, a single waiting vacancy. And now a woman emerged from the crowd. She wore a rusty black dress and held a pail in one hand. A smear of ash stood out on one of her cheeks like a brand. Roland began to shriek. It was a single word over and over again. No, 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 no. The ball's pink light flashed brighter with each repetition, as if his horror refreshed and strengthened it. And now, with each of those pulses, Cuthbert and Alain could see the shape of the gunslinger's skull beneath his skin.
"We have to take it away from him," Alain said. "We have to. It's sucking him dry. It's killing him."
Cuthbert nodded and stepped forward. He grabbed the ball, but couldn't take it from Roland's hands. The gunslinger's fingers seemed welded to it.
"Hit him!" he told Alain. "Hit him again! You have to!"
But Alain might as well have been hitting a post. Roland didn't even rock back on his heels. He continued to cry out that single negative, "No, no, no, no," and the ball flashed faster and faster, eating its way into him through the wound it had opened, sucking up his grief like blood. 25.
"Char you tree!"
Cordelia Delgado cried, darting forward from where she had been waiting. The crowd cheered her, and beyond her left shoulder, Demon Moon winked as if in complicity.
"Char you tree, you faithless bitch! Char you tree!"
She flung the pail of paint at her niece, splattering her pants and dressing her tied hands in a pair of wet scarlet gloves. She grinned up at Susan as the cart rolled past. The smear of ash stood out on her cheek. In the center of her pale forehead, a single vein pulsed like a worm.
"Bitch!"
Cordelia screamed. Her fists were clenched. She danced a kind of hilarious jig, feet jumping, bony knees pumping beneath her skirt.
"Life for the crops! Death for the bitch! Char you tree! Come reap!"
The cart rolled past her. Cordelia faded from Susan's sight, just one more cruel phantasm in a dream that would soon end. "Bird and bear and hare and fish," she thought. "Be safe, Roland. Go with my love. That's my fondest wish."
"Take her!" Rhea screamed. "Take this murdering bitch and cook her red-handed. Char you tree!"
"Char you tree!" the crowd responded. A forest of willing hands grew in the moonlit air. Somewhere firecrackers rattled, and children laughed excitedly. Susan was lifted from the cart and handed toward the waiting woodpile above the heads of the crowd, passed by uplifted hands like a heroine returned triumphantly home from the wars. Her hands dripped red tears upon their straining, eager faces. The moon overlooked it all, dwarfing the glow of the paper lanterns.
"Bird and bear and hare and fish," she murmured as she was first lowered and then slammed against the pyramid of dry wood, put in the place which had been left for her, the whole crowd chanting in unison now,
"Char you tree! Char you tree! Char you tree!"
"Bird and bear and hare and fish," trying to remember how he had danced with her that night. Trying to remember how he had loved with her in the willow grove. Trying to remember that first meeting on the dark road. "Thank you, Si, we're well met," he had said. And yes, in spite of everything, in spite of this miserable ending, with the folk who had been her neighbors turned into prancing goblins by moonlight, in spite of pain and betrayal and what was coming, he had spoken the truth. They had been well met. They had been very well met indeed.
"Char you tree! Char you tree! Char you tree!"
Women came and piled dry corn shucks around her feet. Several of them slapped her. It didn't matter. Her bruised and puffy face seemed to have gone numb, and one, it was Misha Alvarez, whose daughter Susan had taught to ride, spat into her eyes and then leaped prankishly away, shaking her hands at the sky and laughing. For a moment she saw Coral Thorin festooned with reap charms, her arms filled with dead leaves which he threw at Susan. They fluttered down around her in a crackling, aromatic shower. And now came her aunt again, and Rhea beside her. Each held a torch. They stood before her, and Susan could smell sizzling pitch. Rhea raised her torch to the moon.
Char-you tree!
She screamed in her rusty old voice, and the crowd responded, Char-you tree! Cordelia raised her own torch.
Come reap!
Come reap! They cried back to her.
Now, you bitch,
Rhea crooned.
Now comes warmer kisses than any your love ever gave you.
Die, you faithless, Cordelia whispered. Life for the crops, death for you.
It was she who first flung her torch into the corn shucks which were piled as high as Susan's knees. Rhea flung hers a bare second later. The corn shucks blazed up at once, dazzling Susan with yellow light. She drew in a final breath of cool air, warmed it with her heart, and loosed it in a defiant shout.
Roland, I love thee!
The crowd fell back, murmuring, as if uneasy at what they had done now that it was too late to take it back. Here was not a stuffy guy, but a cheerful girl they all knew, one of their own, for some mad reason backed up against the Reapnight bonfire with her hands painted red. They might have saved her, given another moment. Some might have, anyway, but it was too late. The dry wood caught, her pants caught, her shirt caught, her long blonde hair blazed on her head like a crown.
Roland, I love thee!
At the end of her life she was aware of heat, but not pain. She had time to consider his eyes, eyes of that blue which is the color of the sky at first light of morning. She had time to think of him on the drop, riding Rusher flat out with his black hair flying back from his temples and his neckerchief rippling. To see him laughing with an ease and freedom he would never find again in the long life which stretched out for him beyond hers. And it was his laughter she took with her as she went out, fleeing the light and heat into the silky, consoling dark, calling to him over and over as she went, calling bird and bear and hare and fish. XXVI. There was no word, not even no, in his screams at the end. He howled like a gutted animal, his hands welded to the ball, which beat like a runaway heart. He watched in it as she burned. Cuthbert tried again to take the cursed thing away and couldn't. He did the only other thing he could think of, drew his revolver, pointed it at the ball, and thumbed back the hammer. He would likely wound Roland, and the flying glass might even blind him, but there was no other choice. If they didn't do something, the glam would kill him. But there was no need. As if seeing Cuthbert's gun and understanding what it meant, the ball went instantly dark and dead in Roland's hands. Roland's stiff body, every line and muscle trembling with horror and outrage, went limp. He dropped like a stone, his fingers at last letting go of the ball. His stomach cushioned it as he struck the ground. It rolled off him and trickled to a stop by one of his limp, outstretched hands. Nothing burned in its darkness now except for one baleful orange spark, the tiny reflection of the rising demon moon. Alain looked at the glass with a species of disgusted, frightened awe, looked at it as one might look at a vicious animal that now sleeps but will wake again and bite when it does. He stepped forward, meaning to crush it to powder beneath his boot.
"Don't you dare!"
Cuthbert said in a hoarse voice. He was kneeling beside Roland's limp form, but looking at Alain. The rising moon was in his eyes, two small, bright stones of light.
"Don't you dare! After all the misery and death we've gone through to get it, don't you even think of it!"
Alain looked at him uncertainly for a moment, thinking he should destroy the cursed thing anyway. Misery suffered did not justify misery to come, and as long as the thing on the ground remained whole, misery was all it would bring anyone. It was a misery machine, that was what it was, and it had killed Susan Delgado. He hadn't seen what Roland had seen in the glass, but he had seen his friend's face, and that had been enough. It had killed Susan, and it would kill more if left whole. But then he thought of Kaa, and drew back. Later he would bitterly regret doing so.
"Put it in the bag again," Cuthbert said, "and then help me with Roland. We have to get out of here."
The drawstring bag lay crumpled on the ground nearby, fluttering in the wind. Alan picked up the ball, hating the feel of its smooth, curved surface, expecting it to come alive under his touch. It didn't, though. He put it in the bag and looped it over his shoulder again. Then he knelt beside Roland. He didn't know how long they tried unsuccessfully to bring him around, until the moon had risen high enough in the sky to turn silver again, and the smoke roiling out of the canyon had begun to dissipate. That was all he knew. Until Cuthbert told him it was enough. They would have to sling him over Rusher's saddle and ride with him that way. If they could get into the heavily forested lands west of Barony before dawn, Cuthbert said, they would likely be safe. But they had to get at least that far. They had smashed Farson's men apart with stunning ease, but the remains would likely knit together again the following day. Best they be gone before that happened. And that was how they left Eyebolt Canyon and the seacoast side of Mages, riding west beneath the demon moon, with Roland laid across his saddle like a corpse. 27. The next day they spent in Ilbosk, the forest west of Magus, waiting for Roland to wake up. When afternoon came and he remained unconscious, Cuthbert said, "See if you can touch him." Alan took Roland's hands in his own, marshaled all his concentration, bent over his friend's pale, slumbering face, and remained that way for almost half an hour. Finally he shook his head, let go of Roland's hands, and stood up. "Nothing?" Cuthbert asked. Alan sighed and shook his head. They made a travois of pine branches so he wouldn't have to spend another night riding over saddle. If nothing else, it seemed to make Rusher nervous to be carrying his master in such a way, and went on, not traveling on the great road, and that would have been far too dangerous, but parallel to it. When Roland remained unconscious the following day, Mages falling behind them now, and both boys feeling a deep tug of homesickness, inexplicable but as real as tides, they sat on either side of him, looking at each other over the slow rise and fall of his chest. "Can an unconscious person starve or die of thirst?" Cuthbert asked. "They can't, can they?" "Yes," Alan said, "I think they can." It had been a long, nerve-wracking night of travel. Neither boy had slept well the previous day, but on this one they slept like the dead, with blankets over their heads to block the sun. They awoke minutes apart. As the sun was going down and Demon Moon, now two nights past the full, was rising through a troubled rack of clouds that presaged the first of the great autumn storms. Roland was sitting up. He had taken the glass from the drawstring bag. He sat with it cradled in his arms, a darkened bit of magic as dead as the glass eyes of the romp. Roland's own eyes, also dead, looked indifferently off into the moonlit corridors of the forest. He would eat, but not sleep. He would drink from the streams they passed, but not speak. And he would not be parted from the piece of Merlin's rainbow which they had brought out of Magus at such great price. It did not glow for him, however. "Not," Cuthbert thought once, "while Al and I are awake to see it anyway." Alain couldn't get Roland's hands off the ball, and so he laid his own on Roland's cheeks, touching him that way. Except there was nothing to touch. Nothing there. The thing which rode west with them toward Gilead was not Roland, or even a ghost of Roland. Like the moon at the close of its cycle, Roland had gone. 4. All God's Chillen Got Shoes. 1. Kansas in the morning. 1. For the first time in hours, days, the gunslinger fell silent. He sat for a moment, looking toward the building to the east of them. With the sun behind it, the glass palace was a black shape surrounded by a gold nimbus, with his forearms propped on his knees. Then he took the water-skin which lay on the pavement beside him, held it over his face, opened his mouth, and upended it. He drank what happened to go in his mouth. The others could see his Adam's apple working as he lay back in the breakdown lane, still pouring, but drinking didn't seem to be his primary purpose. Water streamed down his deeply lined forehead and bounced off his closed eyelids. It pooled in the triangular hollow at the base of his throat and ran back from his temples, wetting his hair and turning it darker. At last he put the waterskin aside and only lay there, eyes closed, arms stretched out high above his head, like a man surrendering in his sleep. Steam rose in delicate tendrils from his wet face. "Ah," he said.
"Feel better?"
Eddie asked. The gunslinger's lids rose, disclosing those faded yet somehow alarming blue eyes. "Yes, I do. I don't understand how that can be, as much as I dreaded this telling, but I do."
"An ologist of the psyche could probably explain it to you," Susanna said, "but I doubt you'd listen."
She put her hands in the small of her back, stretched and winced. But the wince was only reflex. The pain and stiffness she'd expected weren't there, and although there was one small creak near the base of her spine, she didn't get the satisfying series of snaps, crackles, and pops she had expected.
"Tell you one thing," Eddie said, "this gives a whole new meaning to get it off your chest. How long have we been here, Roland?"
"Just one night."
"The spirits have done it all in a single night," Jake said in a dreamy voice.
His legs were crossed at the ankles. Oi sat in the diamond shape made by the boy's bent knees, looking at him with his bright gold-black eyes. Roland sat up, wiping at his wet cheeks with his neckerchief and looking at Jake sharply. "What is it you say?"
"Not me. A guy named Charles Dickens wrote that, in a story called A Christmas Carol. All in a single night, huh?"
"Does any part of your body say it was longer?"
Jake shook his head.
No, he felt pretty much the way he did any morning, better than on some. He had to take a leak, but his back teeth weren't exactly floating or anything like that. "Eddie? Susanna?"
"I feel good," Susanna said. "Surely not as if I stayed up all night, let alone many of them."
Eddie said, "It reminds me of the time I spent as a junkie, in a way." "Doesn't everything?" Roland asked dryly.
"Oh, that's funny," Eddie said, "a real howl. Next train that goes crazy on us, you can ask it the silly questions." "What I meant was that you'd spent so many nights high that you got used to feeling like 10 pounds of shit in a 9-pound bag when you got up in the morning. Bad head, stuffy nose, thumping heart, glass in the old spine. Take it from your pal Eddie, you can just tell from the way you feel in the morning how good dope is for you. Anyway, you'd get so used to that, I did anyway, that when you actually took a night off, you'd wake up the next morning and sit there on the edge of the bed thinking, what the fuck's wrong with me? Am I sick? I feel weird. Did I have a stroke in the night?"
Jake laughed, then clapped a hand over his mouth so violently that it was as if he wanted not just to hold the sound in, but call it back.
"Sorry," he said. "That made me think of my dad."
"One of my people, huh?" Eddie said. "Anyway, I expect to be sore. I expect to be tired. I expect to creak when I walk. But I actually think all I need to put me right is a quick pee in the bushes."
"And a bite to eat?" Roland asked. Eddie had been wearing a small smile. Now it faded.
"No," he said. "After that story, I'm not all that hungry. In fact, I'm not hungry at all."
2. Eddie carried Susanna down the embankment and popped her behind a stand of laurel bushes to do her necessary. Jake was 60 or 70 yards east in a grove of birches. Roland had said he would use the remedial strip to do his morning necessary, then raised his eyebrows when his New York friends laughed. Susanna wasn't laughing when she came out of the bushes. Her face was streaked with tears. Eddie didn't ask her, he knew. He had been fighting the feeling himself. He took her gently in his arms, and she put her face against the side of his neck. They stayed that way for a little while.
"Char-you-tree," she said at last, pronouncing it as Roland had, "char-you-tree," with a little upturned vowel at the end.
"Yeah," Eddie said, thinking that a Charlie by any other name was still a Charlie. As he supposed, a rose was a rose was a rose.
come reap. She raised her head and began to wipe her swimming eyes.
To have gone through all that, she said, keeping her voice low, and looking once at the turnpike embankment to make sure Roland wasn't there looking down at them. And at 14.
Yeah. It makes my adventures searching for the elusive dime bag in Tompkins Square look pretty tame. In a way, though, I'm almost relieved.
Relieved? Why?
Because I thought he was going to tell us that he killed her himself. For his damn tower. Susanna looked squarely into his eyes.
But he thinks that's what he did. Don't you understand that?
3. When they were back together again, and there was food actually in sight, all of them decided they could eat a bit after all. Roland shared out the last of the burritos. Maybe later today we can stop in at the nearest Boing Boing Burgers and see what they got for leftovers, Eddie thought. And they dug in. All of them, that was, except Roland. He picked up his burrito, looked at it, then looked away. Eddie saw an expression of sadness on the gunslinger's face that made him look both old and lost. It hurt Eddie's heart, but he couldn't think what to do about it. Jake, almost 10 years younger, could. He got up, went to Roland, knelt beside him, put his arms around the gunslinger's neck, and hugged him.
"I'm sorry you lost your friend," he said.
Roland's face worked, and for a moment Eddie was sure he was going to lose it. A long time between hugs, maybe. Mighty long. Eddie had to look away for a moment.
"Kansas in the morning," he told himself. "A sight you never expected to see. Dig on that for a while and let the man be."
When he looked back, Roland had it together again. Jake was sitting beside him, and Oi had his long snout on one of the gunslinger's boots. Roland had begun to eat his burrito, slowly and without much relish, but he was eating. A cold hand, Susanna's, crept into Eddie's. He took it and folded his fingers over it.
"One night," she marveled.
"On our body clocks, at least," Eddie said. "In our heads..."
"Who knows?" Roland agreed. "But storytelling always changes time. At least it does in my world." He smiled. It was unexpected, as always, and as always it transformed his face into something nearly beautiful. Looking at that, Eddie mused, you could see how a girl might have fallen in love with Roland once upon a time. Back when he had been long and going on tall, but maybe not so ugly. Back when the tower hadn't yet got its best hold on him.
"I think it's that way in all worlds, sugar," Susanna said. "Could I ask you a couple questions before we get rolling?"
"If you like."
"What happened to you? How long were you gone?"
"I was certainly gone, you're right about that. I was traveling, wandering. Not in Maryland's Rainbow, exactly. I don't think I ever would have returned from there if I'd gone into it while I was still sick, but everyone has a wizard's glass, of course. Here." He tapped his forehead gravely just above the space between his eyebrows. "That's where I went. That's where I traveled while my friends traveled east with me. I got better there, little by little. I held on to the ball, and I traveled inside my head, and I got better. But the glass never glowed for me until the very end, when the battlements of the castle and the towers of the city were actually in sight. If it had awakened earlier..." He shrugged. "If it had awakened before I'd started to get some of my strength of mind back, I don't think I'd be here now. Because any world, even a pink one with a glass sky, would have been preferable to one where there was no Susan. I suppose the force that gives the glass its life knew that, and waited."
"But when it did glow for you again, it told you the rest," Jake said. "It must have. It told you the parts that you weren't there to see."
"Yes. I know as much of the story as I do because of what I saw in the ball."
"You told us once that John Farson wanted your head on a pole," Eddie said, "because you stole something from him, something he held dear. It was a glass ball, wasn't it?"
"Yes, he was more than furious when he found out. He was insane with rage.
In your parlance, Eddie, he went nuclear.
How many more times did it glow for you? Susanna asked. And what happened to it?
Jake added. I saw in it 3 times after we left Magus Barony, Roland said. The first was on the night before we came home to Gilead. That was when I traveled in it the longest, and it showed me what I've told you. A few things I've only guessed at, but most I was shown. It showed me these things not to teach or enlighten, but to hurt and wound. The remaining pieces of the wizard's rainbow are all evil things. Hurt enlivens them somehow. It waited until my mind was strong enough to understand and withstand, and then it showed me all the things I missed in my stupid adolescent complacency, my lovesick days, my prideful, murderous conceit.
Roland, don't, Susanna said. Don't let it hurt you still.
But it does. It always will. Never mind. It doesn't matter now. That tale is told. The second time I saw into the glass, went into the glass, was 3 days after I came home. My mother wasn't there, although she was due that evening. She had gone into Debaria, a kind of retreat for women, to wait and pray for my return. Nor was Martin there. He was in Cressia with Farson.
The ball, Eddie said. Your father had it by then?
No, Roland said. He looked down at his hands, and Eddie observed a faint flush rising into his cheeks. I didn't give it to him at first. I found it hard to give up.
I bet, Susanna said, you and everyone else who ever looked into the goddamn thing.